Okay, so what we want to talk about tonight is the pagan myth hypothesis. It's also called the Jesus myth hypothesis. And basically the two main guys that are going around, the only two scholars really that are going around arguing that Jesus never existed and that the early church borrowed the story of Jesus from ancient pagan myths, the only two scholars that are trained in either New Testament studies or history are Robert Price and Richard Carrier. Now, I was asked to debate Price, but like I said, that interview wasn't really equal time. And Reggie Finley, the moderator, kept asking me his own questions, which really prevented me from critiquing Price. So hopefully someday I'll be able to get a good solid debate with him. I almost debated Richard Carrier. They asked me to debate him up in the Washington area, but I was speaking at a conference, and I said I could only do it on Saturday. And so they were going to lock it on and decided Saturday was a bad time. They needed it done on Friday, and I was already speaking. So they got one of my friends to do the debate. I don't know how it turned out. Richard Carey is a brilliant guy, but he's just out to lunch. But Bart Ehrman, public enemy number one against Christianity, Bart Ehrman recently wrote a book. I think it was titled, Did Jesus Exist? Where the whole book he argues that Jesus did exist. And then he points out that anybody who thinks that Jesus is just a product of a pagan myth, he knows of no scholar with a teaching position at any accredited university who denies Jesus' existence. So he's basically saying these guys are... they're not representing scholarship. So what we have right now are Richard Carrier and Robert Price. I think were guys who probably denied Jesus' existence before they went and got their PhDs. But whatever the case, if all we cared about was New Testament scholarship, what do the New Testament scholars and the historical scholars say? If that's all we cared about, we wouldn't even be having this lecture. But the fact of the matter is there's a whole lot of atheists, fire-breathing atheists, young atheists who could care less about what historians or New Testament scholars think. And so on the internet, Richard Carrier and Robert Price are, you know, big men on campus right now. So with the internet crowd, there's a grassroots movement denying Jesus' existence. And just give you an example of this. When I debated Doug Kruger, an atheist out of Arkansas, I debated him in upstate New York at State University of New York. And during the Q&A, I believe he was a biology professor from State University of New York, asked me, he said, well, isn't it true that Jesus was never considered God by the early church? And that Emperor Constantine in 325 AD at the Council of Nicaea forced the bishops to start teaching that Jesus was God. And I said, no, that's Da Vinci Code stuff. That's not true to history. In reality, in the early 30s AD, at the very start of Christianity, the early church attributed deity to Jesus and prayed to Jesus alongside the Father as two distinct persons, yet they claimed to believe in only one God. I said, Larry Hurtado, University of Edinburgh, documents this in his work, The Lord Jesus Christ. That's what defines Christianity, was its early binitarian worship. Now, it took a little while to figure out the Holy Spirit's role, and before the full Trinity was extracted from the biblical text. But worshiping Jesus as God was what made Christians Christians right from the start. I mean, doubting Thomas, you want to know how long it took for them to realize, oh yeah, Jesus is God. Is, you know, he's teaching that he's God, and they're thinking, well, this is probably symbolic and figurative language. And then he rises from the dead, and what does Doubting Thomas say? My Lord and my God. So once they saw him risen from the dead, it was like, oh wow, all that stuff he said wasn't figurative, it was literal. Jesus of Nazareth is really God incarnate. And so then the biology teacher kind of looked at me and laughed a little, like I was an idiot. And he turned to the atheist, Doug Krueger, and he said, your response? And Doug Krueger said, yeah, he's Phil's right. And the guy was just like blown away. He said, he's right? And he said, yeah, he's right. And the guy was like shocked that all it now Krueger's got a weird belief where it's like, yeah, the early church believed he was God from the start, but he still questions Jesus' existence too. But he's a philosopher, he's not a historian or a New Testament scholar. But he acknowledges, yeah, the early church did believe he was God from the start, which makes it harder to argue this point. So what I'm going to do, though, is just take some information here. Some of the key people that have argued against this are J. Warner Wallace. I just got to meet him. He went out to eat with him and stuff in North Carolina. He's a former cold case detective. So he wrote the book on cold case Christianity and stuff, and so we hit it off real good because I'm a former police officer. Bart Ehrman here, an enemy of the church, yet he's got really good stuff in arguing in defense, and then that's viewed like enemy attestation. When I debated Mark Fulton from Australia, when I debated him, I kept bringing up Bart Ehrman, what Bart Ehrman said, because when the Darth Vader anti-Christian scholar says pretty much only an idiot would deny Jesus' existence, that carries a lot more weight than if I refer to my old professors who say that. Edwin Yamauchi, this historian is just plain brilliant. You've got to read some of his articles and some of his work. And then, of course, Mike Lacona, he's a friend of mine, one of Gary Habermas's former students. He does a good job of this. Mary Jo Sharp, probably the world's leading, at least in the English-speaking world, female apologist. She's got an excellent article that she wrote refuting this. And then Mark Forman, philosophy professor and a friend of mine from Liberty University, another former student of Gary Habermas. And most of what I'm going to talk about here is based on Mark Forman's work and Mary Jo Sharp. And now Mark Forman, his work is in a book titled Come Let Us Reason, which was edited by Paul Copan and William Lane Craig, and it's chapter 11, and where he deals with this. The most popular exposition of this view, the pagan myth hypothesis, is the Zeitgeist movie. The Zeitgeist movie actually does a pretty good job. Maybe they go overboard in some areas, but showing a global conspiracy to enslave the occupants of the world. But unfortunately, these guys see conspiracies everywhere. And since they're atheists, they don't... they think that Jesus being God incarnate and the savior of mankind is just another one of those conspiracies to enslave man, as if Christianity enslaves. And in reality, it sets people free. But the Zeitgeist movie is real popular on the internet, and there's been others that have attempted as well to claim that Christianity itself is just a myth borrowed from pagan myths. And they give an endless list of supposed parallels with pagan myths and claim that Christianity borrowed from these pagan myths. It greatly exaggerates the similarities and then claims the pagan myth as the origin of Christianity. Now, let me say this. We have already argued for New Testament reliability. We've argued for the New Testament canon of scriptures. We've argued that we could trust the New Testament text. So for all practical purposes, any solid argument for argumentation for New Testament reliability refutes what these guys are saying. Okay? So we've, you know, I don't care how many parallels you can find between Jesus and Osiris. The fact of the matter is there's no historical evidence that Osiris existed, and there's lots of historical evidence that Jesus existed. Okay? I mean, you can go to Jerusalem and you can get really tired visiting all the sites where Jesus walked. Okay? Try doing that with Zeus. Okay? Jesus was a real historical figure. In fact, there's so much documentation for the life of Jesus. I mean, four different either eyewitness accounts or authored by guys who knew the eyewitnesses. But even Richard Baucom from the University of St. Andrews or St. Andrews University argues that all four Gospels were written by... they're all four Gospels are eyewitness accounts. They're either written by eyewitnesses or people who interviewed eyewitnesses, but there's so many eyewitness details that for all practical purposes, these are the testimonies of the eyewitnesses. And but we're going to see that these similarities aren't quite... So basically what I want you to go into this is that, okay, we've already proven that Jesus existed in history and did the things that they claimed he did. After this, we'll get into evidence of Jesus' resurrection and deity. But we've already proven that he existed. Now what we're going to do is just take on their accusations, and we're going to see that these similarities aren't quite as similar as we originally thought, or as a person might think when they hear this for the first time. Okay, so we're going to refer to Mark Forman's work, chapter 11 of Come Let Us Reason, edited by Copan and Craig. First thing that we need to note is that this is a revival of an old, discredited idea. It was the late 19th century, the late 1800s, the history of religion school. James Frazier's The Golden Bough was a book that popularized it. And this idea that Christianity is borrowed from the pagan myths. And New Testament critical scholarship just rejected this view. There's just so much evidence for Jesus' life. And that critical scholarship just rejected it. So this is something that 100 years ago, this was already shot down by liberal New Testament critics because there's no evidence for it. But when you run out of argument, when all you run out of ammunition and all your attacks on Jesus are being refuted, lo and behold, you just resurrect an old one. And you just keep the cycle going, okay? And that's why in resurrection studies the hallucination theory is making a comeback. It was thoroughly refuted, and so it was discarded in the late 19th century, but now it's making a comeback just because they need something, you know? And so that's what's happening here. Now, there are similarities. We need to note that there are similarities in all religions. Similarities do not necessarily imply dependence. Okay? You say, well, Judaism teaches about eternal life, and to a certain degree, Hinduism teaches about life after death, and Judaism teaches... Try starting a religion that doesn't teach about eternal life. I mean, you're not going to gather a whole lot of followers. So just because you're dealing... There's a reason why we call religions religions, and why certain religions have more success than other religions, and there's certain similar themes and all. So the similarities do not necessarily imply dependence. Weak dependence is when you use similar terms to communicate similar ideas. Ronald Nash showed, by the way, I should have put Ronald Nash's name. His Christianity and the Greeks was also an excellent work to look into on this. But even J.P. Moreland's got a few pages on it that are really powerful in his Scaling the Secular City. But we can agree to a weak dependence that sometimes a religion, look at how much Christianity borrowed from Judaism, since it considered itself the fulfillment of Judaism. And when the Jewish Christians had to spread the gospel to a Greek-speaking world, they had to decide, gee, which word are we going to use for God? The Greeks have theos and they have daimonios. And they just arbitrarily said, well, let's use their word theos for God, and then say there's only one true God, and then we'll use the word daimonios for the false gods and say that they're actually fallen angels impersonating false gods. So so that weak type of dependence is no real issue. But the strong dependence claim is the claim that Christianity is based on pagan myths. The mystery religions, ancient mystery religions, are highly syncretistic. What that means is that the ancient mystery religions and ancient pagan religions, by saying they're syncretistic means they like to borrow from other religions. Okay? And that's kind of the strong dependence side. But Christianity, and for that matter, Judaism, very exclusivistic. In other words, they didn't borrow. The ancient Christians were willing to borrow from the Roman myths. They wouldn't have had to flee and hide and worry about being persecuted and being put to death. The Romans loved borrowing from other religions. They borrowed from the Greeks. They never met a god they didn't like. And if the Christians would just do that, they wouldn't have been persecuted. They were very exclusive, very narrow, in that they said, no, only our religion is true, and they didn't borrow from the other religions. Now, let me say this, though, too. Mark Forman points this out. 4th and 5th century Christianity did borrow data from pagan myths in order to connect with the pagan Roman culture. That's not the problem. See, what a lot of these zeitgeist guys will take evidence of Christianity, Roman Christianity, the Roman Catholic Church, borrowing from the pagan myths, and turning December 25th into Christmas, when that was I don't know if it was the Mithras cult that had that perfect holiday and all. And so we did borrow a lot of things from them, like the holidays, and we turned them into Christian holidays. And there was a lot of borrowing from the pagans at that point. But that's more of Christianity establishing itself as the major religion of the Roman Empire and then trying to find common ground with the pagans. What is at stake here is not the 4th or 5th century, it's the 1st century. Was there borrowing that went on then so that Jesus really didn't exist? That's the issue. So anytime you find evidence for 4th or 5th century AD or beyond borrowing, I'd even argue that there are things that we borrowed even earlier than that from the Gnostics that led to heretical ideas like a priesthood that was celibate, that didn't marry, and not eating certain foods, and you know, the list goes on and on. But what's at question here is in the first century, what happened? In first century Christianity was based on the Jewish Old Testament and historical data from the life of Christ. The Christian early church did not borrow from pagan myths. Okay. Here's one of the fallacies that they use that philosopher Mark Forman points out. They act like temporal priority means the earlier caused the later. Okay? And in other words, if there's an earlier belief that's similar to Christianity, a later belief by Christianity, automatically the earlier must have caused the later. And just because it's chronologically before it doesn't mean that there's a cause and effect relationship. Any earlier pagan belief did not necessarily cause later Christian beliefs. Chronology does not determine a cause and effect relationship. You got to do more than just state a similarity. Okay? That's why, like earlier in our conversation on Islam, just because the name for Jesus used by Islam is similar to the name of a false god, and the name of the false god was known of before time, it doesn't necessarily, for scholars, automatically mean a cause and effect relationship. You need some more evidence to make that link. And that's not what you have for these pagan, ancient pagan myths in Christianity. Forman points out the entire theory assumes that Jesus did not really exist in history, yet this goes against the consensus of about 99% of New Testament critical scholars who acknowledge that Jesus actually did exist. Historians as well, probably the same percentage. That's why our history books, don't expect any time soon the history books to start deleting Jesus' name. If they do, it'll be more of a political action than a due to historical research. Even liberal, skeptical New Testament scholars acknowledge Jesus' real existence in history. Marcus Borg, he just died recently, the Jesus Seminar, Marcus Borg, John Dominic Crossan, Gerd Ludmann, Bart Ehrman now. So even liberal, skeptical New Testament scholars who are not believers, some of them don't even believe the New Testament is reliable, yet they acknowledge there is some reliable information in the New Testament, and it's very obvious that Jesus of Nazareth did exist. Another fallacy that Mark Forman points out about the Zeitgeist-type pagan myth hypothesis is the generalization fallacy. It artificially combines all religions into one model and acts like there was one universal belief system, such as sun worship, and then all the religions copied that. And there's no evidence for this. Okay, the myth theories connect the dots based on the life of Jesus, and then they artificially use Jesus' life as the grid, and they collect only parallels with Jesus, not differences. So it's kind of like they take the life of Jesus and they just assume, okay, this is just one of the ancient variations of worship of the sun, S-U-N, and then they plot out different parts of Jesus' life, and then they just take from pagan myths and say, okay, yeah, here's the death and resurrection type things. And it's just an artificial reconstruction, but they only talk about the parallels, not the differences. We're going to see that the parallels aren't as parallel as they make them sound. Okay, then there's the terminology fallacy, where they use Christian terminology to describe pagan beliefs. By the way, if you watch my debate with Doug Kruger, he's supposed to be interrogating me, and he starts giving a quote that there was a miracle worker who walked the land of Palestine in the first century A.D. He caused the blind to see and the deaf to hear, but I recognize the quote. It's a bogus quote from one of these Jesus myth hypotheses in the late 19th century or early 20th century. But the guy is grossly exaggerated because it's supposed to, the real singer is at the end when you think he's going to say, and his name is Jesus of Nazareth. Instead he says that his name was Apollonius of Tyana or whatever. And it's just like, it just blows you away. Well, he's using Christian terminology to describe the life and works of Apollonius when there's not real good evidence that Apollonius actually did these things, and there's not even claims that he did all of these things. And so I knew I had to prevent that effect from the audience. So as soon as he started saying, I recognized it, and I said, oh, come on now. You're not gonna bring up that bogus quote about Apollonius, are you? And he got all red in the face and embarrassed and just dropped it. And so, but the effect can be, I tell you, the first time I read that quote, it shook me until I found out that, no, the guy really doesn't have any historical basis for making those similarities. If we get time, we'll talk more about Apollonius and using Christian terminology to describe pagan beliefs, I mean, you take pagan beliefs and you could use words that the pagans never used in their mythology, like resurrection. Virgin birth. Okay. Even just calling Jesus God. Sometimes some of these pagan entities weren't even called God. But you could take all salvation, blood atonement. I mean, the list goes on and on. And you could just retell pagan myths, and instead of using their words, insert the word resurrection. Instead of talking about a weird birth, like being caused by some fruit falling from a tree, just call it a virgin birth. Talk about the founder or this pagan deity offering salvation through a sacrifice, even the word sacrifice, or blood atonement. You use enough Christian terms to describe the pagan belief, terms that the pagans didn't use, and it starts sounding a real lot like Christianity. But it's all sleight of hand. Okay? And so using Christian terminology to describe pagan beliefs causes Christianity to superficially resemble the pagan religions. Terms like Messiah, baptism, virgin birth, resurrection, new birth, crucifixion, the list goes on and on. The pagans actually rejected the idea of a bodily resurrection. That's why the Greeks had such a hard time embracing biblical Christianity, because they didn't, they believe, they weren't looking for a bodily resurrection. They were looking for the soul to escape the body and the immortality of the soul. Okay? Osiris is, like, here's an example. Osiris is killed by being chopped up into 14 pieces. 13 pieces are put together by his mate, Isis. I'm not gonna name the one piece that Isis couldn't find who had mixed company, okay? I know you're thinking, wow, this sounds like Christianity. No, it doesn't. It doesn't sound like it at all. And then Osiris becomes a lord in the underworld. So it's like Michael Cohen says, that's a zombification, it's not a resurrection. Okay? Zeus masturbates on a mountain. His seed produces a pomegranate tree. I can't pronounce it. Attis's mother sits under the tree. Fruit falls on her lap, and she becomes pregnant with Attis. Wow, doesn't that sound like the virgin birth? No, it doesn't. Krishna, the 7th century A.D., that's the first time you get an account of a virgin birth of Krishna. So that's already 600 years after Jesus. But he's supposed to be born of a virgin, yet his mother already had 7 children and was not really a virgin. Okay, I don't know how they define virgin, but a virgin is not a lady who had 7 kids already. Then there's no real crucifixions. Attis, Krishna was, so there's no real crucifixion within Attis. Krishna was shot in the foot. Horus is only depicted with his arms outstretched. He's not crucified. And they just immediately say, well, his arms are outstretched. He must have been crucified. So, by the way, it's amazing how much, especially when you get to Mithras, I don't know if I talk about it later here, Mithraism, it's actually the top of the next page, based on only 3 writings, writings or drawings on walls, like cave walls or artifacts. So, I mean, sometimes all you get is a picture on the wall. And they draw all this, this is just like the gospel, these same types of things. And it's just the imagination of the anti-Christian scholar. No real resurrections before Jesus. Horus and Osiris both become lords in the underworld. Attis was transformed into a pine tree. Doesn't sound like a resurrection. Krishna, early tradition said he went to the underworld. But by the 4th and 5th century A.D., yes, he was resurrected. But if any borrowing went on, they borrowed, the Hindus borrowed from Christianity. Because it's after Jesus rose. Well after, hundreds of years later, and Christianity is now being preached, and even in Hindu lands. You have disappearing deities reappearing, but it's not a real resurrection. It's not a bodily resurrection from the dead. And so basically, when everything is said and done, you have absolutely no dying and rising gods before Jesus. Okay? So, if you have somebody like Krishna that's supposed to have predated Christianity, if there's a resurrection, it comes hundreds of years after Christianity and after Christianity is proclaimed in that land. But when you go back to the pre-Christian writings of Krishna, there's no resurrection. If you have a quote-unquote resurrection that's recorded in pagan writings before Jesus, you look at it and it's not really a resurrection. It's not a bodily resurrection to this life. It's the guy becomes a king in the underworld, the world of, in Hades or whatever. So there's absolutely no dying and rising gods, no evidence of dying and rising gods before Jesus. anybody who counters that, disagrees that, they're going against all the historical scholarship and history of religion scholarship. And most of the scholars in those fields are not Bible-believing Christians, but they acknowledge no dying and rising gods before Jesus. And the non-biblical fallacy, the Zeitgeist does this to really destroy people's faith. They say it makes claims about Jesus not found in the Bible. They show that December 25th was originally a pagan holiday worshiping a pagan god, and that there's no evidence Jesus was born on December 25th. Now, if that destroys your faith, you don't know enough about your faith, because the Bible never tells us when Jesus was born. The church arbitrarily chose December 25th and chose to replace a pagan holiday with a Christian holiday. Then they say that we don't know that there were three kings. Well, the Bible doesn't even call them kings. It calls them magi, and they gave three gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh, but we're never told that there were three. So basically, they take Christian mythology, Christian ideas that many Christian believes that really aren't found in the Bible, and then they show us that those ideas aren't found in the Bible, in hope that that destroys our faith. I remember Doug Kruger did something like that when he said, but now no one, now hardly any scholar believes Paul wrote Hebrews. And I said, well, there was never a universal belief that Paul wrote Hebrews at any time in the church. And he said, yeah, well, it says right where it starts, it says that Paul wrote Hebrews. I said, no, it doesn't. I said, when's the last time you read the book of Hebrews? Hebrews doesn't start out saying that it was written by Paul. In fact, the author of Hebrews in chapter 2 says he never met Jesus. So obviously it wasn't Paul. And so the fact that some early church fathers thought it might have been Paul and others thought it wasn't Paul, it's probably a good argument that it was written by one of Paul's colleagues and associated with his circle. But the fact that most scholars now acknowledge Paul didn't write Hebrews is not something that should cause us to stagger. In fact, I don't even believe Paul wrote Hebrews. So what's the big deal? And then the chronological fallacy, there's no evidence of any pagan influence in first century Judaism. No evidence of dying and rising gods before Christianity. The pagan religions may have borrowed from Christianity as it grew. You know, as Christianity grew, they said, well, we got to compete with Christianity. Maybe we need to borrow from Christianity. In fact, that's what the Apollonius cult actually did. So if borrowing went on, it was the pagans borrowing from Christianity as it grew. It wasn't Christianity borrowing from paganism. In Mithraism, the Torobolium, that's where these people would walk under these planks and a bull would be slaughtered up top and the blood would initiate them into that religion and the blood would be poured all over them. And so a lot of people say, okay, that what they would do there is they say, well, that's Christians teach that people are saved by the blood of the Lamb, and they got that from Mithraism, which predates Christianity, and they have this practice where the bull is slaughtered and the blood is poured out. Well, number one, there's really no comparison whatsoever. The Christians were never pouring blood on themselves, okay? It was a lamb, not a bull. Also, those of the Mithras cult never viewed it as being saved that way, just their initiation into the cult. It wasn't referred to as salvation or baptism. So, but there's actually no evidence of this practice until the 3rd century AD, 200 years after Jesus. So, if you see a parallel there, I don't. If anybody borrowed from anybody, it would have been the Mithras cult borrowing from Christianity. And then, as I said before, Mithraism, no written text, only drawings on caves or artifacts, or comments by a few ancient writers, mostly after first century AD. Basically, what I'm saying is, and what Mark Forman is saying is, we have little to no knowledge of what Mithraism was before Christianity. So anything we know about it, we get from later on, and the evidence is so little that you got to fill in the blanks, and it's easy to fill in the blanks by borrowing from Christianity to fill in the blanks, and then saying Christianity borrowed from them. Then there's the source fallacy. It's not the quantity that's missing, but the quality that's missing. In other words, if you look at their, they'll have citations, so if they write a big book that Jesus is a myth, and you'll have thousands of citations, they're citing sources. The problem is the quality of these sources really stinks. Okay? They can't quote from the leading historians because they all acknowledge that Jesus existed. They can't quote from the leading New Testament scholars because they already acknowledge that Jesus existed. So they usually quote from some pretty far out guys with some pretty wild views. Their case is built not on primary sources but secondary sources. So they can't even quote from, you know, to get something that looks like a resurrection, they can't quote anything pre-Christianity. So they'll quote from something 5th or 6th century AD and say, see, they got a resurrection here, and this religion was around longer than Christianity was, before Christianity was. So Christianity borrowed the concept of the resurrection from them, when there's absolutely no evidence that before 500 AD that religion ever had that view. Okay? It's built on secondary sources, not primary sources. It would be like me, if I quote, nothing wrong with it, but if I quote from Walter Martin about the cult, about Mormonism, that's a secondary source. If I quote from authoritative Mormon writings, that's a primary source. Now, I think in that case, the secondary source, Walter Martin, the author of Kingdom of the Cults, is a reliable source. He's done really good research. But the fact of the matter is that's a secondary source. Well, these guys are using secondary sources that are not considered reliable by experts in the field. That would be like me quoting a former Mormon as an expert on Mormonism when he's a secondary source, he's not a Mormon prophet. And then there's some pretty good evidence that he's just, you know, the Mormons kicked him out and that he's really upset with them, and the things that he's saying, no Mormon scholar acknowledges that as true Mormon beliefs. And so these are sources that have been rejected by scholars. They also interpret the text the way they want in a very controversial way. It's a lot like the ancient alien things. They go and they see an Egyptian writing on a wall, and they see an Egyptian drawing that looks like an alien. And they go right from there to the assumption that the Egyptians were visited by alien beings. Well, maybe they were. Maybe the ancient gods that the Egyptians worshipped were demons impersonating themselves as aliens. But the fact of the matter is, there's 100 different ways to interpret that drawing. Just because you think it looks like an alien doesn't mean they were really drawing an alien. And just watch the Ancient Alien program someday, and you'll see just wild speculation that is not considered scholarship by any way, shape, or form. The authors that they quote are rarely ever experts in religion, yet they quote them as if they're experts in religion. They're not experts on Egyptology, yet they quote them as if they're experts in Egyptology. So in other words, you have a guy telling you what the ancient Egyptians believed in religious areas, and the guy's not an expert. The guy might have been a journalist, but he's not an expert on religion, and he's not an expert on what the Egyptians believed. And they have virtually no authoritative sources for ancient pagan beliefs. So even their views of the pagan beliefs, they're not really getting that from the, if you go to the authoritative sources about the ancient pagan beliefs, you get a lot less than what these guys are saying, and what you get doesn't even look anything like Christianity. Okay? Then there's what Mark Forman calls the difference fallacy, which overemphasizes similarities while ignoring huge differences. For instance, the mystery religions were cyclical. They believed history repeats itself, whereas Christianity is linear. It's moving in one direction, moving towards the return of Christ and the resurrection of believers. The mystery religions were cyclical. They were secret, whereas Christianity was taught in the open. Beliefs were unimportant in the mystery religions, whereas beliefs were very important in Christianity. The mystery religions' ethics, they didn't even teach what was right and what was wrong. All that mattered was the religious experiences. Christianity is very ethical. There is right and wrong. The mystery religions could care less about history. No historical context. Christianity, history was everything. We can identify the approximate time Christ was born, the approximate time that he had his public ministry, the approximate time when he was crucified. All this can be known within a few years of estimation because of the great concern for history. Jesus died for our sins, according to Christianity. No pagan deity died for others. Pagan deities, when they die cyclically and unexpectedly. Rather than, Jesus dies once for all for the sins of mankind, and it was prophesied in the Old Testament. But the pagan deities, they actually die. It's all has to do with the crop cycles, and when vegetation dies in the winter, and then it comes back to life in the spring, okay? And it's all tied in to the seasons. And so it's basically they just look at the way nature operates, and they make up stories, myths. Those who are writing the pagan myths didn't even believe in their myths. Those who wrote the Gospels were willing to die for what they taught. And so most of the parallels are forced to fit. There might be some parallels, very few, but no evidence of dependence at all. What Mark Forman does, too, is he gives an example of Kennedy's assassination. It would be like saying, well, I don't think John F. Kennedy really died. I think it was a myth based on the Lincoln myth, because you have real parallels there. You have Lincoln. Yeah, Kennedy. Lincoln was elected in 1860. Kennedy was elected in 1960. Okay? Killed by a lone gunman. Killed by a lone gunman. Lincoln's vice president was Johnson. Andrew Johnson. Kennedy's vice president was Johnson. Lyndon Johnson. Okay? think Lincoln had a secretary or somebody on his staff named Kennedy. Kennedy had a secretary or somebody on his staff named Lincoln. Okay, Lincoln, the nation mourned. Kennedy nation mourned. This goes on and on. It's like, wow, we got so many parallels here. It's pretty obvious that John F. Kennedy is a myth. His assassination is a myth based on the Lincoln assassination, which may have been a real fact or it may have been a myth itself. And it's just the same myth that runs throughout. By the way, they have touted this for generations or for decades. And now I think there's a few of the parallels that were actually made up. There's no evidence that they really were true. But all the ones that I listed except this one, you know, are true. And there are many more that you could list. I mean, it's astonishing. You know, even in fact, Gregory Boyd and Paul Eddy wrote the book The Jesus Myth, where there's about 500 pages refuting this. And you can see there that both Lincoln and Kennedy fit pretty well the hero myth. Just like a storyline about a great hero who dies for this cause and everything. But the fact that these were real historical guys, and they fit, there's parallels with mythology that they fit real well with. But it doesn't mean that we should throw... if we're going to throw Jesus out due to these parallels, then we should throw out Lincoln and Kennedy due to their parallels with each other and with the hero myth. Yet, the parallels are stronger for these two than they are with Jesus and the pagan myths. So we'd have to throw the historicity of these two out first if we're even thinking of throwing out the historicity of Jesus. By the way, the first century AD evidence for Jesus is so strong that if you were to throw out Jesus, and that's what I told Robert Price, I said, if we're going to throw out Jesus, we should throw out everything from the first century AD. If we use the same principles for Jesus that we used there. And his response was, I'm okay with that. And so everything we know about Julius Caesar and all these others, we would throw that out. So that doesn't make any sense. Now, there's a few other points I want to make. There's a lot of stuff. If you move forward from where we're at, about page 14 in the Fernandez Price debate notes, and so these are some other things I just want to point out here in the closing minutes. But according to Dr. Craig Evans of Acadia Divinity School, Dr. Price promotes the discredited Christ myth theory of the 19th century. So Price wants us to ignore 150 years of progress in critical studies. So he's basically saying is the whole Jesus myth hypothesis is outdated. And Boyd and Eddy, in their work with the Jesus myth, said that the legendary Jesus theorists have 8 basic assumptions. First off, they assume naturalism, that miracles are impossible. Okay? So right off the bat, they're not going to accept Jesus' miracles. They've got to explain them in some other way. Secondly, they argue that the first century Jews, especially Galilean Jews, Jews of the north where Nazareth was, were Hellenistic. They're influenced by Greek culture, if not pagan. That's an assumption. All the evidence goes against that. Like, for instance, what is it, in Nazareth, where they found absolutely no pig bones. They've never found pig bones there. I mean, if they were greatly influenced by Greek culture, you'd expect to find pig bones. I mean, why not have pigs? I mean, bacon, pork, a lot of good food, but they weren't that influenced by pagan culture. They believe in the legendary parallels to the Jesus story. They believe there's silence about Jesus in ancient non-Christian writings, when in reality Josephus talks about him, Pliny the Younger, Suetonius, Emperor Trajan, Emperor Hadrian, Thallus, Tacitus, the Jewish Talmud. There's lots of non-Christian sources within. In fact, within 150 years of Jesus' death, 42 authors mention him. Okay? Now, of those 42, a portion of them are the New Testament authors. Okay? But the emperor that day, Emperor Tiberius, there's only 10 mentions of him within 150 years of his death. So when people act like, well, if Jesus was God, he really did what the New Testament teaches, shouldn't there be more mention of him? Well, he's already 4 times as many mentions of him as the emperor of his day. And Jesus never even held political office. Now you tell me why a carpenter from that poor town called Nazareth gets more press, 4 times more press than the Roman emperor. And but they also act like there's silence about Jesus' life in Paul's writings. You realize these guys are actually even go so far to say that Paul Paul's writing his stuff and Jesus didn't exist. He's just writing a few years later. Robert Price has to explain Galatians.
Number two,
either he assumed somebody else told him about the life of Jesus, or number three, he assumed they had read about the life of Jesus. I'm one of the few Christian apologists today that believes that Paul didn't have to go in great detail about writing about the life of Jesus, because at least some of the Gospels were written before Paul started to write the 49 AD. It just amazes me that we just bow down before liberal New Testament scholars and act like Paul is writing before any of the Gospels were written. If Paul was writing before any of the Gospels were written, you know what he would have done? He would have written his own Gospel. Okay? But he knew it was such common knowledge. He even says that, and it's probably Luke, that he's going to send to them the brother who's famous for his Gospel. And if he meant famous for preaching the Gospel, then that's all of Paul's colleagues. I think he was talking about Luke and the fact that by the time Paul's writing, I think, 2 Corinthians, Luke's Gospel is already famous. And I write about that in Hijacking Historical Jesus. They also believe there's unreliable oral traditions behind the Gospels. All the evidence is against that. And the Gospels are contradictory and unreliable. You can't make a case for that. And that the burden of proof rests on those who argue for the reliability of the Gospels. No, it doesn't. The burden of proof is on the one who wants to attack the historicity of the Gospels. And so I'm just going to mention the general responses to myths and legends by J.P. Moreland, and then put a bookmark in that page, because we do need to touch on some of these other responses. I want to get into Apollonius of Tyana, Sabbatai Savi, and Simon Kimbangu, because these are three examples that... See, what Robert Price does is he says, Jesus didn't exist, but he knows nobody believes him. So he says, and if he did exist, it's still possible to turn a non-miraculous guy shortly after his death into a miracle worker, because I've got three examples of how that happened. That within the lifetime of his contemporaries, he was turned into a miracle worker. In fact, let's just do that. Let's just close it here, and we'll pick it up with J.P. Moreland's general response to the myths and legend theory, and then go on from there. Now, if anybody has any questions, we got a little bit of time. You could ask some questions. If not, if you want to hit the road and get home a little early, that's fine too. So, does anybody have any questions on this? This is more popular. I tell you, to be honest with you, this is way more popular among teenagers than it is among adults. Most adults, the life of Christ has been drilled into their heads to where, you know, and they've read secular history books that still talked about Jesus. I mean, 1985 World Book Encyclopedia states on the section on Jesus Christ, he was probably the greatest man who ever lived. So that's saying two things. He actually lived, and he was probably the greatest man who ever lived. That doesn't sound like Robert Price and Richard Carrier are on the majority side of this issue. So, but if you don't have any questions, we'll just pick it up there next week. So we'll spend one more week on the Jesus myth hypothesis, then we'll get into evidence that Jesus claimed to be God and that he bodily rose from the dead to prove those claims true. And then after that, we'll give evidence for the the inspiration and inerrancy of the Bible. And then after that, we might discuss a little bit about creation and evolution, and a little bit on cultural apologetics. But we'll see how that goes. So, all right, God bless you.